WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the best movies of 2001 has just come out on video and DVD, The Royal Tenenbaums. It appeared on a lot of critics' 2001 10 Best lists. Wes Anderson directed and co-wrote the film. Anderson also made the films Bottle Rocket and Rushmore. We're going to listen back to the interview I recorded last December when The Royal Tenenbaums was released. It's a comedy about a dysfunctional family of geniuses. Royal Tenenbaum, played by Gene Hackman, and his wife Etheline, played by Angelica Houston, separated when their children were young. Royal is part businessman, part con man. He runs a lot of emotional swindles on his family. He's never accepted his adopted daughter as an authentic member of the family. The three Tenenbaum kids were child geniuses, but when they grew up, they were each stunted by family disasters and betrayals. The grown-up children are played by Ben Stiller, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Luke Wilson. In this scene, the father, Royal, is broke. He owes so much money to the luxury hotel he's been living in that he's been evicted. Having no place to go, he tries to return to the Tenenbaum home, where he knows he will not be welcome. So he needs a scheme. He tells the family he's dying of cancer and wants to reconcile.
I've missed the hell out of you, my darlings. Well, you know that, though, don't you?
I hear you're dying.
So they tell me.
I'm sorry.
Well, I've had a good run.
You don't look so sick, Dad.
Thank you.
What have you got?
I got a pretty bad case of cancer.
Ugh, how long are you gonna last?
Not long.
A month? A year?
About 6 weeks. Let me get to the point. The three of you and your mother are all I've got, and I love you more than anything.
Oh, oh!
Chaz, let me finish here. Now, I've got 6 weeks to set things right with you, and I aim to do it. Will you give me a chance?
No.
Do you speak for everyone?
I speak for myself.
Well, you've made your views known. I'll let somebody else do some of the talking now.
What do you propose to do?
I can't say, really. Make up for lost time, I suppose. First thing I want to do is take you out to see your grandmother at some point.
I haven't been out there since I was six.
I haven't been out there at all. I was never invited.
Well, she wasn't your real grandmother. And I never knew how much interest you had, sweetie. Anyway, you're invited now.
Thanks.
Dysfunctional family is perhaps the most common subject now in contemporary fiction and in a lot of movies. What made you think that you could take on the subject and still have something else to say? It seems like so much has already been said.
Yeah. Well, initially, my writing partner, Owen Wilson, and I, he'd always been encouraging me to write about my parents' divorce. He always thought there was something there that would be a good basis for something. And so that's what I thought we were doing, but the more we worked on the script, the less it had anything to do with my family or my parents' divorce, and the more it was sort of invented, and the more dysfunctional it became. It kind of just went off on its own. So I sort of feel like as we developed it, we invented a lot of new things, and then it kind of started to find its way back to people that we knew, and little bits of things from real life. But it was sort of like when it became not about my family that it started to get really severe.
Well, there is a line I particularly liked about divorce in the movie when Gene Hackman is explaining to the three children that he and his wife are separating, that the parents are separating. One of the kids says, "Daddy, is it our fault?" And he says, "Well, it's true. We did have to make many sacrifices to have you children."
Yeah, the worst thing, an honest answer is probably a terrible idea under those situations.
Did you pop the question and get an answer like that when your parents were divorcing?
Well, that's funny because that scene, there's a scene, you know, where they're talking to their father about are they going to split up, and that's a real scene I have two brothers, and the three of us had this conversation with our father, but none of the father's answers are anything like what my father said. Every answer that the Gene Hackman character gives is the truth, which has got to be highly destructive to the children.
So your father gave you the right answers?
He gave us the right answers, yeah.
Each of the children in the Tenenbaum family has a certain look that they stick with through all or most of the movie. I'd like you to choose a couple of characters and talk about the look that you gave them and why.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing in the story is that they're all sort of they're sort of stuck emotionally in the same place where they were 20 years ago. And they're also stuck in terms of the clothes that they wear and the way their rooms look and everything. It's all sort of just cemented in about 1978. So the tennis player that that Luke Wilson plays, Richie, is he wears a headband for the whole movie. He always looks like he's just about to head out to the courts, even though he hasn't picked up a racket in 6 years or something. And his whole look is sort of modeled on Bjorn Borg in the late 70s.
Right.
Gwyneth Paltrow, her character is sort of wears one of these like fourth grader Lacoste dresses that looks like a big shirt and a mink coat. I don't know why those go together, but somehow they seem to. And penny loafers. Ben Stiller goes through the whole movie in a red Adidas warm-up that identical to the ones worn by his two sons. And I think the idea for that, I was just sort of thinking they could always spot each other in a crowd. It's like for safety purposes. He's obsessed with their safety. So
because his wife died in a plane crash.
Right.
Then there's the boy next door who desperately wants to be part of the Tenenbaum family and is always showing up at the door when he's a child. The grown-up version of this character is played by Owen Wilson, who's also your screenwriting partner for the film. Are you familiar with this kind of character, or is this kind of character based on you? Was there a family in your life that you really envied because they had such like an interesting house and interesting parents and
creative
siblings?
No, very much. I mean, as much as sort of devoted as I am to my own family, I do remember a series of families over the years that I always was trying to get myself adopted into. Because of the things that were going on in their houses, and that's definitely where this Eli Cash character that Owen plays comes from. That's actually a good example of what's invented in the movie and what comes from real life, and hopefully kind of how we rely on both of those things, because the character that he plays is initially this sort of concoction of a kind of a Cormac McCarthy, but it would be like Cormac McCarthy if he was living in New York and going out to cocktail parties every night. He's a Western novelist, but I think he wouldn't be very comfortable on horseback. You know, I think his fringe leather jackets are custom made, probably in L.A. but the real kind of heart of that character has to do with his. Him growing up, you know, across the street from this family that he really wanted to be a part of, and his kind of longing to be one of them.
Wes Anderson is my guest. He directed and co-wrote The Royal Tenenbaums. The story of The Royal Tenenbaums is set in New York, but it's an idealized version of the city, and all the landmarks are fake. Instead of the 92nd Street Y, there's the 375th Street Y. I don't think there even is a 375th Street.
Yeah, I think the 375th Street Y would probably be in Yonkers.
Right, right. Yeah. Why did you want to shoot in New York but have a kind of fake version of New York that you were operating with?
One thing that was one of the my sort of initial thoughts about it, I kind of am thinking about the setting before much of anything else, and I just had this idea of this sort of exaggerated version of New York, and I feel like, which is just fun to make up all the details to the place, but also I feel like it sort of creates a setting where the kind of unusual behavior of the characters can seem appropriate somehow, because the setting is so exaggerated and is a little bit unreal.
And why did you set your movie in New York?
Well, because I've always had this sort of semi-obsession with New York and all the things that I've felt like it represented, having to do a lot of which came from the New Yorker magazine, which was my consistent exposure to New York for all through high school. And I always felt like it seemed like people were up to so many different things around the city. All these people had their own little projects, and that's kind of what the movie is partly about, I think. And then I live there now, so it's you know, it's kind of a big thing for me.
In your movie, The Royal Tenenbaums, the family lives in, well, this almost mansion in New York. It's an old building with a turret, I think you'd call that a turret, the rounded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with a flag on the top.
Yeah. Now, I read about you as a kid. You used to draw pictures of dream mansions that you would have liked to live in. How did you get that sense of place, that sense of interest in mansions?
Well, you know, for a little while, I wanted to be an architect. But I was also, along with being interested in buildings, I was also, for a period of time, I'm embarrassed to say that I was obsessed with being rich. I was interested in limousines, and I was interested in mansions, and I was interested in the fanciest restaurants, and it was like a James Bond kind of thing that I was really drawn to. I wanted to learn how to play Baccarat. And so I think between the ages of about 8 and 12 or something, that was what I was reading about.
My guest is Wes Anderson. He directed and co-wrote the movie The Royal Tenenbaums. It just came out on video and DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Wes Anderson. He directed and co-wrote the film The Royal Tenenbaums. It just came out on video and DVD. I want to ask you something about the pacing of the movie. Early on in The Royal Tenenbaums, you're just finding out detail after detail about each of the children in the family. And there's so many like sight gags and verbal jokes, and it's just like one laugh after another. And the plot isn't necessarily advancing, but the character detail is. And at some point you're wondering, when is this going to slow down and the real story will evolve? And at about that point, it slows down and the story evolves. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about pacing the film and what you had to figure out with that.
Right. I was always a little worried because we do spend quite a bit of time on, basically what happens is we give this whole story of the family history. Then we introduce each character today, and there are 8 main characters, and we introduce them in the bluntest way you can. We show an image of them with the name of the character and the name of the actor, and we go on to the next one. Then we go to the present. We revisit each in the present, and a narrator kind of walks us through where they are now. So we end up doing kind of 3 tours through all the characters, and it takes up the entire first reel of the movie. And I was always worried, can we do this? Can we spend this much time laying the groundwork? But I was also worried that if we didn't, it would just be completely confusing because there's so many characters and what they're up to is not really a very familiar territory. But we were very conscious that once that was done, we needed to get right into the story. It may require some patience.
The song that really stands out that you used in your previous movie, Rushmore, was Summer Song by Chad and Jeremy. Talk about how you chose the records that you use in the background for The Royal Tenenbaums.
Right. Well, for me, the songs are always a part of the writing process. When we were doing Rushmore, I had this idea of British Invasion, and I just listened to lots of that, and I had some favorites that I liked. There's a song called Making Time by a band called The Creation that almost became like sort of the theme of the movie, I think. It sort of led me into this whole British Invasion thing. And the new movie, I felt like there was a song by Nico, it was written by Jackson Browne, but sung by Nico. And there was also this Ravel string quartet in F major. These two pieces of music I had from the beginning. And somehow I felt like there was something kind of half Scott Fitzgerald and half Velvet Underground that was going to be the sort of sound of the movie. And in a way, so it almost influenced the way the movie looks, I think, because when you're outside in the movie, it's a little bit like sort of 70s New York. There's a lot of graffiti and stuff, and it's kind of like the French Connection or the Warriors period of New York. But the rooms inside feel like maybe they're more like the 30s or something. I don't know what. I feel like that sort of came out of the mixture of music. And there is something to me sort of New York about a lot of the music, even though it's, you know, even though there's Beatles and there's Van Morrison, and there's something about the feeling of these songs that makes me think of New York.
You have some great actors in the Royal Tenenbaums, and Gene Hackman's at the center of the movie, and he's just so much fun to watch. I know you worked really hard to convince him to star in the film. What did you learn about how he works?
Well, I think he's quite different in his approach to a scene from anybody else I've worked with. There's something about him where he wants to be. He's very prepared when he arrives to do a scene, but he somehow manages to make it completely spontaneous as soon as he launches into it. And I don't think he even really knows what he just did after he finishes a take. He somehow manages to sort of take all this preparation and then just block it out and just dive into the scene. So whenever you're starting a scene with him, there's this real feeling of his attack to it and this energy that he brings to it. And it's very different from other actors who I've worked with. A lot of actors, which I enjoy also, is, you know, people who want to discuss it and think about it and want to try some different approaches. He likes to figure it out and then just launch right into it. What I really think he likes to do is to be great on the first take and just immediately, you know, grab a hold of it.
You've worked with Owen Wilson on your three movies. He's co-written them and he's starred in two of them. How did you meet?
Owen and I met. We went to school together in Austin, and we had a playwriting class together. We didn't actually meet in the playwriting class. We were in this class together with about five other people, but we were both the sort of non-participants in the room. Owen would just sit in the corner reading the newspaper. And I sat in the other corner. I think I was trying to write something during the class, but neither of us really quite joined in. But I think we recognized each other as you know, kindred spirits or something. And then we met, you know, shortly after that. I think I met him in the halls. He asked me about which creative writing class he ought to take. And he acted like we already knew each other, so I acted like we already knew each other, too.
Has it been interesting to know each other for so long and both end up with pretty successful careers?
I think we've been really lucky to have each other as we kind of figure out all this movie stuff, because I think it can be pretty easy to lose your bearings a little bit. I feel like the Coen brothers, those guys seem so secure in their whole approach to movies, and they seem just very, like, and I feel like the two of them going through all the stuff together have really helped to keep each other quite focused and sort of on track. And I feel like, you know, I'm glad to have had Owen and Luke also, and so we could sort of guide each other a little bit.
Your movie has a kind of generosity of spirit, even though it's a comedy about a dysfunctional family and everybody's totally screwed up. There's a spirit of forgiveness, finally, and a sense that the good of family can really outweigh the bad. Is it easy for you to feel as generous in real life, both about family and about people maybe within the family who you've had to forgive?
I don't feel like I've had... my experiences with the family are not really like the ones in the movie, so I don't really feel that... I don't know. I guess everybody has a certain amount of that stuff. What I feel like is that the movies that we make, I'm drawn to some kind of optimism or something about the characters, and I want to have an affection for the characters, and I also feel like we're drawn to characters that are very flawed and capable of very questionable behavior. But somehow I always feel like I don't want to have bad guys. And I don't know exactly how that relates to how I feel in real life. Um, But I don't know. That's the kind of movie that I'm drawn to.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Wes Anderson directed and co-wrote the film The Royal Tenenbaums. It's just been released on video and DVD. Our interview was recorded in December when the movie was released theatrically. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.